Welcome to the Fatigue Super Conference. And this is going to be an interesting one because in this session, I'm the one being interviewed. And I was just saying to Nick, who's going to be interviewing me, that I realize it's rather easier being the interviewer, although that's an unfair thing to say to Nick when I've at this point done dozens of these interviews for the conference. But this is the first in a series of videos that Nick and I are going to do together, really targeted at those supporting people suffering from fatigue and related conditions. And the reason why Nick's going to be interviewing me is Nick's wife, Lisa, had her own journey with ME chronic fatigue, so on the more severe end, let's say, of the kind of general fatigue spectrum. And she was a patient with us at the Optimum Health Clinic. And Nick then obviously was in a supporting caring role for Lisa, and then went on and has been doing our therapeutic coaching practitioner training program. So Nick and I've got to know each other a little bit through that. And it was actually Nick that came to me and said, I think you guys should do something, or we could do something together, really to give more understanding, more support for those caring for people with fatigue-related conditions. And I thought that this online conference will be a good place to start some of that process. So Nick, welcome, and thank you very much for being with me.
No problem at all. Yeah, as Alex was saying, the main thing is it gives me an opportunity to ask those questions that I would have loved to have been able to ask when Lisa became ill and when we were sort of working our way through that entire maze of her illness. So I guess the first one is that I know when Lisa became ill, every doctor we saw seemed to have an answer, and that answer was inevitably tied to their own speciality. And that often gave us these great moments of hope where they would say, yes, it's endocrinological, so we'll be able to give it that sort of cure. And they just failed one by one by one by one. And is this something you often see?
Yes, unfortunately. And I think it can be even more complicated than that, because I think you have such a range of perspectives. So if you go down the more traditional medical path, often you can get met with one of two perspectives. Either the perspective of, I can't find anything wrong with you, therefore there is nothing wrong with you, or there's something wrong with you and I don't understand what it is, therefore it's incurable or untreatable and there's nothing that can be done. And a cynic might say that's the kind of arrogance of a traditional kind of allopathic or orthodox medical system, that we know everything there is to know, and therefore if we don't know what's wrong with you or we don't know how to fix it, then no one else does. So you either kind of get that those kind of perspectives, or what you were describing, Nick, where you kind of go to your gastroenterologist or your endocrinologist or your cardiologist or whatever, and they look at it for a very specific lens, and they have the answers that kind of go with that particular lens. And I liken it a little bit to, you go to the butchers and you say, I'm having a dinner party tonight. Do you have any suggestions? Like, you know, what would be good? And they'll say, well, Nick, yes, we have some fantastic steaks in tonight, or some great lamb cutlets, whatever it might be. And then you go to the fishmonger and say, we're having a dinner party tonight. Watch that. We've got this fantastic lemon sole. It's just fresh off the catch, you know, this morning. And people tend to see things through the lens of how they see it. And they will, it's not that they're necessarily being cynical or skeptical of rejecting of other things. They're just not looking. And I think that becomes incredibly frustrating for people that are used to suffering from more kind of acute medical conditions, where you break a bone, you break your arm, for example, and you go to accident, emergency, or whatever, and they x-ray your arm and say, yep, it's broken here, and we need to give you potentially some painkillers for the pain, we need to kind of make sure the bone's set, maybe put it in a cast, and then come back in 6 weeks, we'll make sure that it's all kind of healing as it needs to. So those kind of specific things, or if somebody has got, you know, a kind of clear medical condition like diabetes, it's like, okay, you need to kind of be injecting insulin, you know, assuming it's type 1 diabetes, there's certain things we need to do. But when you get something like a lot of the fatigue conditions, you know, ME, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, Lyme. These things are multifaceted with multiple components happening in different ways. And all of these systems are all interlinked. And so something goes out of balance in one place, it affects something in another place. And that can be just, I think, as you're describing, just very, very confusing. And as someone who was 23 years ago that I first got sick, and, you know, then having recovered after 7 years and then spent, I think it's now 16 years kind of specializing in helping people, I still find it like doing this conference, I'm still learning stuff all the time. So I think for someone that's new on that journey, or indeed medics that don't see a lot of it, I think it's very confusing.
And I think one of the things that we really saw is it's not that they weren't necessarily finding things that weren't right or were wrong. For example, the endocrinologist found a pituitary tumor and treated that. But then we were then left in this situation where we didn't know whether then the medication for that was contributing to this fatigue. And it was all that, yeah, there was no sense of, there wasn't any holistic approach, or there wasn't any talking to other medical professionals or sort of engaging with them and saying, actually, let's attack this from a wider viewpoint rather than this very narrow viewpoint, like you just said.
Well, it's interesting. And I think it's something that is beyond even fatigue related conditions, I think is a kind of systemic problem within kind of much of modern healthcare. And I can't speak so much about other countries, but I think it's probably true there. But certainly in the UK, even just looking at my mother and stepfather, you know, in their kind of, you know, early 70s with, you know, various kind of ailments and things that are going on, and just how little communication there'll be between the different people that they're seeing. And actually, it takes a significant amount of kind of self-responsibility and kind of ability to piece together things oneself. And sometimes, often with fatigue-related conditions, it takes quite a lot of self-confidence and ability to articulate oneself and to stand for one's rights and to kind of, you know, be willing to, you know, a lot of us can have a kind of relationship to the medical world. And I see this a lot in my parents' generation of kind of, well, they're the experts, they know it all, and you shouldn't ever question it. And if they tell you to do this, you do this. And it takes a certain kind of challenging of that and going, but hang on, do you realize I'm doing this? And actually this person said this. And that's a quite a big mindset shift for people to take that kind of responsibility in that process.
And I know you talk about a diagnosis of exclusion a fair amount. Can you explain a bit more about what that is and what you mean by that?
Yeah, well, if we start, well, firstly, I think we should say that the labels that we have for these conditions are not fit for purpose, I think would be a kind of a blunt way of putting it. So we've either got the kind of, certainly more in the US, one tends to get the chronic fatigue syndrome or the fibromyalgia diagnosis. Here in the UK, people are more likely to get a myalgic encephalomyelitis or ME diagnosis. There's also beginning to become a bit more awareness around Lyme as a kind of as a specific diagnosis. On the more nutritional therapy functional medicine path, people may be more likely to get an adrenal fatigue diagnosis. So we have these different labels which are used in different ways. But I think these labels are in of themselves, I think, are utterly flawed, because it's a little, you know, I remember when I got diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome and going to the doctor and saying, I'm tired all the time. I haven't got the energy. Just going to the doctors was like a massive event. You know, it was the biggest thing I'd done in a month just to be able to go to doctors at that point to get a diagnosis. I'm saying I'm chronically exhausted. And it's like, you've got chronic fatigue syndrome. And it's like putting the word syndrome on the end of what I've already told you, which is I'm chronically tired. It's not a diagnosis. It's you know, and I think these labels, and there's been a lot of kind of frustration and infighting and kind of battles, really, even within the communities of sufferers of these conditions, around what labels we should use, around, you know, what diagnostic criteria that we should use. And certainly it's a little bit different for Lyme, although with Lyme there's a lot of questions around the testing there of getting a lot of false negatives, and that's a whole other kind of piece. But with certainly with ME chronic fatigue, there are certain symptoms that one has to have, such as fatigue being one of the primary symptoms. There has to be no other explanation for those symptoms. And if there's no other explanation and you've had those symptoms, and depends upon which diagnostic criteria you use, whether it has to be for 3 months or 6 months. The diagnostic criteria we use here in the UK, it's 6 months for adults and 3 months for children. But again, that's a whole other kind of point of debate. So it's basically, if you have this set of symptoms, there's no other reason why you have these set of symptoms, then you get a diagnosis. And it's called a diagnosis of exclusion, because basically all you're doing is excluding other explanations for the symptoms. There is no biomarker at this point in time. And it's something that we at the Oxfam Health Clinic, with our research work, have been trying to push forward. The challenge is there needs to be more recognition and definition of the subgroups, because we're not talking about one population that have all the same things going on. We would argue, and it's one of the things that I think will become clearer to people that have gone deeper into some of the interviews within this online conference, that there are subgroups around mitochondrial function, people where the primary cause of fatigue is they're not making energy on a steady level. There are subgroups around digestive function. There are subgroups around, adrenal function. Same with Lyme. So actually, we're unlikely, in fact, I would place a fairly large bet, we will never find a single biomarker that effectively diagnoses this whole population. I think it's a series of biomarkers. The not having of that has all kinds of problems that go with it. And beyond the problems around not having clarity of diagnosis informing on treatment, it's also had a significant impact on influencing cultural perception of these conditions, because kind of culture and society is used to, you know, you have, for example, something like cancer, you go and have various investigation, you get a diagnosis of cancer, and you can see that in various lab reports that would support that. That lack of a biomarker is what supported a lot of these ideas with fatigue, that people are making it up, or it's not real, or it's psychosomatic in some way. And it goes back to my earlier point that I think it's a incredibly high level of arrogance of orthodox medicine to say, we don't understand what's happening, therefore it doesn't exist.
I mean, when I look back in hindsight, which is obviously a lot better, there were so many possible causes for her. There was, you know, there was an instance of glandular fever when she was working at the BBC. There was hormonal imbalances from the pituitary tumor, medication to correct this, a really stressful dealing with her father's estate. The list goes on and on and on. And my feeling now is that it was like an imperfect storm of all of these factors in interacting and contributing. Do you agree with that?
I think so. And I think this is where no two cases really are the same, even though there are, you know, we have certain maps, ways that we kind of piece together what, you know, effectively we see recovery as about having a jigsaw, and you've got to have the right pieces to that jigsaw. It's kind of a similar thing in terms of someone getting sick in the first place. It's a series of things that come together, and rarely is it just one thing. I mean, there are instances, but they're rare, where somebody has a very significant thing that happens, be that, you know, a kind of a viral thing, maybe that's Lyme or kind of some co-infections, or they have a massive emotional trauma of, you know, their in a kind of come back from a war zone and they've got PTSD, and that then has a major impact in terms of their energy levels and their nervous system. But normally what you have is it's like kind of loads on a boat, and you have a series of these different loads, and it's no one load on its own. It's the cumulative effect, or, you know, another metaphor would be, it's like straws on a camel's back, and it's the kind of final straw that breaks the camel's back, not the kind of 1,000 straws or 100 straws, whatever that came before. And, you know, these factors can be, you know, many, many different things. They can be I think we're going to come into this a little bit, but certain kind of psychological factors that may be going on, is in terms of kind of personality tendencies. They can be viral factors. They can be life events, some of what you were describing. And these things together gradually kind of weaken the system. I think one of the big challenges that happens then is, it's not just what causes someone to crash and become sick. it's also what stops people from healing. And suddenly you've got this whole new stress. If you think about, let's say someone's used to creating 100 units of energy a day, and they're used to spending a range of kind of, you know, 80 to 100. And if someone stays within that balance, then, you know, as long as they spend 100 every day, you've got a little bit of reserve, and then it's a little bit like money. If you earn £100 a week and you spend £80 a week, life's good. You earn if you earn £100 a week, you spend £101 a week, life's bad. And so, in fact, Sarah Myhill talks about this in her interviews as part of the conference. So there's what can happen is that then the amount of money you're earning or energy you're creating starts to go down. So if you were creating, you know, 100 units of energy, you're down to 80 or 60 or 50. So people will say, well, you know, I'm not doing anything. I've completely reduced my activity. I'm resting all the time. But if you're still out of balance there, that maybe you're creating 60 and you're spending 70 and you're like, but I'm doing 30 less than I was before. So then you start to have this kind of stress of being ill, that you're trying to struggle with life with depleted resources. It takes energy to heal, and there's not energy that's then available to heal. And then you can get in a bit of a slippery slope where you do less, but you're still crashing and it's still too much. So there's the factors that build up to someone getting sick, what we call predisposing factors. There might be some kind of trigger, like some final straw, some big thing that happens. And then there's the kind of cycles that people get stuck in when all these factors have kind of layered on top of them. And sometimes you start to deal with those predisposing factors, but you also have to deal with the kind of where someone is at that point in time.
And I know when a doctor who happened to be a friend of mine, who is a sports doctor who's worked with a number of pro cycling teams, he actually tentatively suggested the ME/CFS diagnosis for Lissa. And I remember her reaction to him saying that was actually quite sort of, no, I don't want that. I haven't got that. That's not real. Is that something you encounter and see?
Yeah, I think so. I think that there can be quite a significant trauma sometimes of diagnosis, you know, and there's been some interesting research that's been done on other medical conditions of how someone is told that they've got something, and the way that that's framed, the way that that's presented, can actually have an impact on outcome, because it kind of determines how someone responds to it. And so, you know, and that, and again, I'm jumping ahead a bit here, but it's some people will say, you know, that these conditions are psychosomatic. And the thing that I always say is, if you're going to make up a condition, you do better to make up one that society has more respect for, right? You're more likely to get some sympathy and some empathy if you choose better. So there's a kind of, it's one of those conditions. There's so many cultural stereotypes around it, be it kind of yuppie flu in the 80s, be it the kind of, you know, comedy, you know, interpretations that people have about this, that it is not a diagnosis that people want to have. And it is getting that diagnosis that people can be very defensive. You go, that's absolutely not me. Or it can feel like a temporary relief, like at least I've kind of got a sense of what this is. And then there's often a overwhelm when one realizes that the path out is, at least in kind of orthodox ways, is not a very straightforward or easy or even guaranteed path out. And I think how one responds to that diagnosis, I think I think getting a diagnosis is important. There might be people that are watching this where their loved ones are kind of almost self-diagnosing and thinking, well, I must have this because I have all these symptoms that are going on. I would always very strongly encourage someone to go and make sure they have got a proper diagnosis, because there are other conditions which are medically identifiable that can create all of these sorts of symptoms that A, could be a path to a much simpler path out, and B, not tackled appropriately, could also result in things not being dealt with and things getting worse. But if one has got this diagnosis, realizing that it is something that doesn't have to be a life sentence, but it is something where one is likely to have to take the kind of bull by the horns and be the one that, or indeed people watching this as the carers around people, that one's kind of support network is going to play a crucial role in changing the outcome from, you know, just having to learn to live with a condition like this.
And I think one of the things I saw at that time was I really had to give her space and time to accept and come to terms with that diagnosis. And there was no point in me trying to sort of push her towards, because I instantly sort of started, because the doctor actually recommended the OHC. And I instantly started sort of Googling it, looking at it, saying, well, that looks great. You should go on that. And she just wasn't ready at that time to do that.
I think that can be common. And I think when one is suffering with particularly severe fatigue, one feels a gradual loss of control in their life. So if someone's used to having a career or going out with friends and family, having choices about kind of what you want to do at the weekend, and suddenly kind of you're doing less and less because your energy is kind of getting less and less. The kind of the last thing someone wants to feel is that, and even now, I'm not even in control of what happens next in terms of the recovery path. And so it can be, particularly with teenagers, one of the real challenges can be that there's a kind of, you want them to feel they've still got some control over their kind of their destiny in their life, but it's also getting them to open up to the potential that things can be different. And I've had a number of times over the years working with teenagers where I spend the first 2, 3, 4 sessions just trying to engage them in the idea of A, accepting that something really is going on, and B, that they could play a role in being able to change that. But I know that, when I was ill, I spent 2 years basically in hell. I mean, struggling to do an hour or two schoolwork from home a day, barely able to go out, in pain, severe fatigue, often nausea, dizziness. And I went through 2 years of hell until I had basically a conversation with my uncle where I said, I don't want to live anymore. It wasn't that I was actively planning my suicide. I just couldn't face it. And I was helped to realize that if I wanted the circumstances to change, I was going to have to be the one to change them. But I wasn't ready to hear that 2 years earlier, and I could be quite stubborn by nature. And although I had been doing a few things in those 2 years, kind of driven by my grandmother, ultimately, when it really changed was when I took responsibility for that. And, as you were saying, Alyssa, it's you can't really enforce that upon somebody. You have to kind of give them space and be patient and try and stoke the kind of light the flame or stoke the fire a little bit. And, ways I think that can be helpful is, people sending people links to interviews like this, sending links to other parts of this online conference, books of people that have been through, my books, I think, been a good source for some people of reading a recovery story and kind of identifying them in that. But I think, it's a tough one. I think particularly for carers or for friends and family, that if you can see some things that someone can do and they're just like, they're not ready to hear it, you're seeing them suffer, you're kind of suffering alongside them. It takes a level of patience and skill to kind of navigate with that.
Yeah, I think in hindsight, I probably could have managed that situation better, but I just wasn't equipped at that time to do that. You've already touched on the psychological aspect. And I know with Lissa, it was one of the aspects of her treatment that initially she was really quite hesitant about and sort of quite, well, that's telling it's in my head. Why do I need that? But in actual fact, it's actually been probably the thing that's contributed most to her recovery, and it's the thing that she's used ongoing as part of her as part of her recovery. But equally, we've got a friend who has quite bad fibromyalgia, and she won't even contemplate any form of psychological intervention because she thinks that's people saying it's in your head.
Yeah, it's a really good point. In fact, there's an interview as part of this online conference with Nikki, who's one of the psychology team at the Optimum Health Clinic. And it's called, or at least it is at the moment, it might be changed by the time it goes live, but at the moment it's tentatively titled Psychology is Physiology. So that's a really good one for people to check out, because in that dialogue, she talks about her, she was working as a physiotherapist, so was very much in the kind of traditional kind of medical model mindset, and talks a bit about her own journey to recovery and her understanding and realizing how the psychology and the physiology interrelate. So that's a good one to check out. But just to give a few comments from my perspective around it, I think we have to, one of the things that's really important to understand is that the kind of cultural way of talking about the role of psychology in a condition like this is people's inference is that it's psychosomatic, that it's like what someone's experiencing is not real, It's simply a case of it's imaginary in their head and they believe it's real, which I would put in a similar category to like phantom limb pain, where an amputee has had a leg removed for whatever reason, and they still have pain in a leg that's not there. So that's psychosomatic. It's like there is that. It's not to say the pain isn't real, and the brain's interpretation of that pain can have genuine suffering. And I'm not trying to diminish that experience. But what's important to understand is this is not the same as that. This is not that someone is, you know, has some kind of unconscious kind of thought pattern around illness, and therefore they're manifesting illness through that. What we're talking about is psychology playing a number of different roles, and as I think will become abundantly clear from this online conference, that there's all kinds of complex physical processes that we see as being crucially important. But as we're looking at it right now from a psychology point of view, psychology plays a role in what we call these predisposing factors that I just loosely mentioned earlier. Things like if people are achievers by nature, where they measure their self-worth by kind of what they do and what they achieve in the world. Or if people are helpers, where their kind of self-worth is measured by what they do for others. If people are kind of have a sense of kind of anxiety by nature, they tend to worry and kind of, you know, be in a kind of perpetual state of kind of overstimulation in their kind of thinking. Or if there's some kind of trauma that's happened that hasn't been digested and processed and therefore is kind of triggering the nervous system. So these are what we call energy depleting psychologies. They're ways of meeting the world which are inherently draining and depleting. Would those factors alone cause someone to have mild fatigue? I think they would. Would they be the primary cause of someone having a kind of a severe state of chronic fatigue? It's unlikely. It goes back to what you were mentioning earlier, Nick, around it's kind of loads on a boat. There's multiple factors. But we have these kind of predisposing factors. We then have what I also touched on a little bit earlier about this idea of the stress of living with a chronic illness. And we at the Optimum Health Clinic, or OHC as people often refer to it, call this maladaptive stress response, where our nervous system is in an ongoing state of overstimulation. That can be for a number of reasons. It can be because we're depleted in our normal energy, like our mitochondria are not functioning as they need to. So we're constantly using our adrenals to keep us going. So it can be a physically induced state of sympathetic nervous system arousal of being overstimulated. Or it can be that we've kind of got this ongoing anxiety of what's wrong with me? Why is it wrong with me? Will I ever recover? Should I rest? Should I not rest? Should I push myself? How will I feel tomorrow? How am I going to explain to this person that I can't do the thing I was going to do? So this kind of then creates this ongoing state of our nervous system being stimulated. When we're in that state, it's very difficult for the body to heal. You know, there's again various places in this online conference people talking about the impact of the sympathetic nervous system being on and not having that parasympathetic healing state. It affects digestion, it affects our hormones, it affects our sleep. There are people where just calming that down alone has a massive impact on the recovery path. There are other ways that psychology that kind of play a role as well. Just briefly, learning how to pace and listen to one's body is crucial, like how much one does. And that not being a kind of printout from a CBT practitioner that says, this is what you should be doing each day, because that's just going from one's kind of own pushing themselves to someone else's plan. It should be a listening to the constant messages and feedback from one's body. So learning to do that, learning to actually like feel things, like feel emotions, feel your body's communications. How to be one's own best coach, how to support oneself through the highs and the lows and the challenges, how to deal with these subtypes I mentioned of defining one's self-worth differently from just achievements and helping. So there's lots of these factors that it's not that any one of those things alone is like a magic bullet, which then is the cause of recovery. It's that we need to ultimately break the habits where we are constantly pushing our system and doing too much. The body needs to be in a healing state where its own healing processes can happen. And we're talking about recovery from, you know, certainly kind of the more kind of severe ends of the fatigue spectrum. being as kind of complicated as trying to climb Mount Everest in terms of the nuance and the details and what each day, the different decisions that need to be taken. So being able to be one's own best support, you know, if you're only with a practitioner once a week or once a month, that's a lot of hours of decisions that need to be made that we try and coach and support people in how to best take care of them themselves.
I think that's a really good analogy, the climbing Mount Everest, because yeah, part and parcel of that is you go high and then you come back down again, you go a bit higher, you come back down again. And that's really what the recovery process felt like and still feels like to a certain extent with Lissa, in that, you know, we'll make these progressions forward and she'll make these progressions forward. But, you know, inevitably they usually then follow with a little slip back. It won't be quite back as far as she was, you know, so sometimes, although sometimes they have been, but it's a constant back and forwards. It's not a linear process by any stretch of the imagination.
And that's right. And that's very common. And that's kind of going back also to what we were saying earlier on around this idea of people really have to become the captain of the ship of their own recovery. And it's a fundamental shift in one's relationship to really the kind of medical system and the medical world. And just, you know, it's kind of good timing us recording this conversation, because I'm at this point kind of probably 2/3 of the way through the other interviews that we've done. So just thinking of another one, James Maskell talks about the evolution. I can remember the title of the interview, but it's basically the evolution of kind of functional medicine and healthcare. And he talks about the importance of the role of being responsible really for one's own recovery, and the role that community can also play in that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I really found that with Lissa. I think what I found one of the sort of most positive contributions I'm able to make to her recovery is actually it's reminding her that this has been the sort of progression all the way along. And when she's, you know, sort of pushed her, bounced her boundaries a bit too much, and she's having a little bit of a mini dip, I'll say, yeah, Sil, but you know, if you tried to do that 6 months ago, you wouldn't be having a mini dip, you'd be having a full-on crash.
Yeah.
And it's sort of that process of sort of, you know, trying to maintain objectivity and just reminding, because I think there's been a lot of cases where she doesn't actually remember how ill she was. And whether that's her protecting herself or whatever. And as part and parcel of that, she doesn't really sort of have a clear sort of timeline of her recovery in the same way that I have. And I think providing that support and, you know, helping her to steer that ship is really important.
It's funny, we talking about climbing mountains, there's a kind of classic, there's certain patients or certain moments over the years with the Optimum Health Clinic, which are just kind of, I think, stuck in all of our minds, because they're kind of either because they're emotive or powerful, or sometimes just because they're funny. And I'm allowed to laugh at this one because the patient involved actually at the time was also working for our admin team. So we kind of became friends with it as well. But he came into a session. It was like, you know, how are you doing? It was like, oh, just terrible. I just feel as bad as I was kind of, you know, a year or so ago. And as a practitioner, you kind of sat there thinking, oh man, that's what I do. I wonder what's going on, because you're doing so much better. And this is a kind of throwaway kind of comment. So, you know, what were you up to kind of at the weekend? Oh, I climbed Mount Snowdonia. Someone that's gone from kind of like almost being housebound to kind of climbing like to one of the tallest mountains in the UK. It's like, I get that you feel terrible, but we have to have some context in terms of what's happening here. And so there's kind of this, I think that you're right. And I know we'll talk in one of our subsequent dialogues around the how you can be supportive to someone that's going through this. But I think you're absolutely right. That just that kind of more objective outside perspective, which is very hard to do when you're just kind of consumed by living in this incredibly difficult, you know, probably I think most people will say that have been through, you know, fatigue, and particularly the more severe ends, will say it's the hardest thing they did in their lifetime. And I think it's an important context to keep that in sometimes.
So it's no wonder, looking back, that if there were potentially so many factors involved in her illness, it's no surprise that no one treatment worked for her at all. And sort of that multifactorial approach was just so key.
So one of this is going to be a confessional moment for me. One of my biggest frustrations in the kind of really the health, the kind of self-help and natural health movement of the last kind of 25, 30 years, is this kind of consistent theme that happens where somebody will be suffering from some kind of chronic illness, and often it's a fatigue-related condition, and they will try a number of things along the way. Then they will go and do this one thing, which seems to be this kind of miracle answer for them. And, you know, if we go back 25 years ago, that was often people doing like an anti-candida program. Or, you know, over the years, there's been different kind of psychological approaches. There's been different supplements, different kind of fads is a strong word, but kind of themes of things that have kind of been popular at certain points in time. And you have a few people that go and do that approach, and it's the answer for them. And then inevitably what happens is those people end up going and training in that approach. They end up going out there and kind of saying, this is the answer. And the truth is, and I could say this, I think, fairly confidently, having overseen the, you know, Optima Health Clinic supporting thousands and thousands of patients in over 40 countries around the world, that there is no one answer. And there is rarely one answer for each individual, let alone one answer that's the whole picture for everyone. There are patterns and there are clues and there are key pieces and there are building blocks that everyone should be doing. But when we're going out there in the traditional kind of germ theory model of medicine, where there's a pathogen and we need to find something to kill a pathogen, like there's a single problem and a single solution, we end up getting just disappointed and frustrated and overwhelmed in that process. And unfortunately, that's fed by the simplistic perspective that a lot of books tend to take, where they're presenting a particular approach. And so inevitably, they, in a biased way, take all the evidence that supports that approach. And nutrition is one of the best examples of that. You know, if you were to take the nutritional advice of everyone in the kind of nutritional medicine world, you would not eat. I can tell you that every single food would end up, if you take a kind of one diet and they say you can't eat these foods, so you take those ones out, go to another diet, so you can't eat these foods. If you go long enough on that process, you will have no food left. And so there's this kind of frustration of that there's all these things offered as one answer. And actually what we have to do is, again, it goes back to being the captain of the ship of our own recovery and working with skilled practitioners that are able to take a big enough distance from the jigsaw to not just be looking at a few pieces, as we were saying at the start, go to the butchers and say, what should I have for dinner? Because I can tell you now, they're not going to recommend you have a raw food dinner. So you have to kind of have this recognition of these different pieces. It's immensely complicated. And if there wasn't so much suffering that's involved, I would say this is the most fascinating jigsaw in the world. But I wouldn't want to infer that there's a pleasure in the solving of that puzzle because of this, the level of suffering that people are going through.
I totally agree. I mean, I know Lissa really went through, I've referred to it as her clutching at recoveries phase, yes. Where she was, you know, she was reading every sort of book under the planet. And I mean, one case, I can't remember what exactly the book was, but it was a very sort of evangelical story of somebody following a graded exercise plan. And that really appealed to her mindset of being able to sort of make a spreadsheet of how she was going to increase her exercise daily. And this was going to sort it out and this was going to cure it. It absolutely wiped her out within about a week and a half and was totally wrong for her. And then she sort of started sort of grabbing at every single nutritional book there was and cutting things out of her diet. And I think she bought up Holland and Barrett from a supplement point of view and just started hosing all these supplements into herself. And I remember when she actually finally came to talk to the nutritionist at the OHC and she told them what she'd been taking. The nutritionist went, well, you're obviously quite robust if you've been able to tolerate all of it. Yeah, she was looking for that single answer and it just wasn't there.
It's obviously completely understandable human nature to want to find answers. And indeed, people wouldn't find Optima Health Clinic if they didn't have that drive to find answers. The challenge is that drive to find answers often results in people self-medicating so many supplements that all they do is just have incredibly expensive poo because it's just too much for the body to be able to deal with. And I've said a few times on this online conference that one of my only real fears with this online conference is that someone might listen to all of the interviews, take everything that's recommended and do it all at the same time, which is like a terrifying prospect. That it's, in a sense, that's where a really skilled practitioner comes in. And it's also where one's own capacity to kind of piece together the jigsaw comes in, that you can do all the right things in the wrong sequence and it will not work and make things worse. You can do 9 right things and 1 wrong thing and it not work. You can do, you know, you can do all the right things in too much and it cannot work. And that's where one really has to be patient, one has to be persistent, and one needs to kind of be figuring it out as they go along. And I think we do a great job at the Optimal Health Clinic of fast tracking and simplifying that process, but it's still a process and it's still a journey that we go on with the people that we support, as I know that you know.
And almost in summary, is it fair to say then that CFS, ME, fatigue, it's an umbrella diagnosis that in reality it's actually just describing a range of symptoms rather than one specific condition?
It's such an appalling diagnosis in the sense that we really do need to, and I think it's what the functional medicine world is doing, is certainly doing really well. And you know, looking at, you know, these interviews, it's interesting that people will notice if they go through all of the interviews on this conference, that there are certain practitioners which come very much from a kind of what in a traditional medicine world would call an endocrinology kind of perspective. So they're looking much more at hormones and blood sugar, things like the thyroid. There are others that are looking much more at a kind of from immune perspective. They're looking at things like Lyme, co-infections, that sort of thing. Others looking much more from a kind of digestive perspective. So this kind of recognition and definition of different subgroups, different kind of systems, different parts of the jigsaw is what's happening in the functional medicine world. It's certainly the model that we've been using for the last 16 or so years here at the Optimum Health Clinic. But it's, in a sense, you have to kind of move beyond it, this kind of idea of Lyme or chronic fatigue or adrenal fatigue or fibromyalgia or ME to kind of, it's a set of processes that are happening in the body and things that are out of balance that might not be like adrenals that are completely failed and you're kind of in Addison's disease, for example, but they're suboptimal functioning. And that's having an impact on perhaps digestion, and that's having an impact upon energy, and that's having an impact upon how the brain's functioning. There's all these interlinkages. And it is fascinating and it is complicated and it requires that kind of understanding of the jigsaw, the map, the picture, the kind of the sequences of how things work. And I think the sooner people in their own minds, even though the label can be useful to a point in terms of communicating to others, the sooner one can move beyond, I have this label, to understanding these different factors of what's happening, you're then in a much more empowered place in terms of what do you actually do about it. Because knowing that you have chronic fatigue or Lyme or fibromyalgia doesn't tell you what to do. It just gives you a label of a set of symptoms.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was, you know, when Lissy had got that diagnosis and once she had accepted it, it was only really once she started her treatment with you guys that I felt we were making any progress at all. And that actually we were sort of going through methodically and working through what the possible contributing factors could be and almost, you know, chopping those trees down one by one.
Yeah.
And that's what it felt like. It felt like sort of, you know, felling a forest.
Yeah. So just to give people a kind of sense of what's to come, Nick, I know we're going to do another session together exploring what one can do to support their loved one. I think that one will be probably a bit more collaborative because I've got some questions to you on that because I'm curious, you having kind of been through that. And I know sorry, go on.
I think it's mainly going to be the mistakes I made and what I could have done better. But yeah, sorry, it's all about this.
Well, we can share on that because, as I know, you know, perhaps we'll come into in that dialogue. But my sister-in-law ended up with Lyme disease 5 or 6 years ago. So I also got to be the role of carer because she lived in my house for 2.5 years. So I will share with you and we'll swap stories of how we've been made those mistakes. For now, Nick, thank you for the great questions and look forward to talking together in our next session.
Look forward to it as well. Thanks very much.